When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
Get your shopping done right this holiday season with Big Air Columbus. Right now, you can get $100 off Elite Player Passes at Big Air, which is unlimited play all day, any day. Or buy one $25 gift card, get a free pair of holiday grip socks, plus a 1.5 hour pass to use after the new year. Big Air is the perfect gift for the kids in your family. So get your holiday shopping done right with Big Air Columbus. Stop by today inside Fieldhouse USA at the Polaris Mall or online at BigAirUSA.com.
Save faster, borrow smarter, move sooner with CME. Earn 6.5% APY with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus savings account. And when you're ready to buy, enjoy a low 5.1 ARM mortgage rate. Plus, CME pays $750 toward closing costs. Start your path to homeownership today with CME Federal Credit Union. Subject to membership eligibility and approval, APY means annual percentage yield, APR means annual percentage rate. Terms apply. Federally insured by NCUA. Equal housing lender. Visit CMEFCU.org for details.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. This week, we have maybe our most dizzying stack of source material yet.
It's a lot to get through.
It really is. We're dealing with three completely distinct high-stakes narratives. We're going from the details of a massive domestic fraud scheme to a huge shift in American foreign policy, and then, you know, right over to extreme volatility in global finance.
That's it, exactly. And for you, the mission today is really crucial. We're going to try and synthesize all this disparate information.
To give you the context.
Right, the context and the key takeaways that, you know, that link all this political, ethical, and economic instability. We're going to zoom in on the sheer scale of a $1 billion scandal in Minnesota, pivot to the controversies around Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
And the administration's new national security strategy.
And then finally, we'll try to decode that sudden snapback in market expectations about the Federal Reserve.
Okay, let's start with Minnesota, because the facts of the crime and, I mean, the sheer audacity involved are just staggering.
They really are.
Federal prosecutors are calling this the largest COVID-19 fraud scheme in the country. They're alleging the total take was over $1 billion.
A billion. And we've got nearly 60 defendants convicted so far, with charges just filed against the 78th person.
So it's not just the size, it's how systemic it was.
That's the key. The exploitation was systemic. The initial focus, this all started back in 2022, it was targeting the federally funded child nutrition program.
And the sources detail how these defendants claimed they were setting up feeding sites.
Yeah.
Supposedly for thousands of kids a day.
Supposedly. But the truth, according to prosecutors, was, well, it was pure fiction.
So these sites weren't real?
No. Many of them were just parking lots or vacant commercial spaces. Some, you know, never served a single meal. The paperwork was all forged, but the public money, it got wired anyway.
And some of the specific details we have really crystallize how brazen this was.
Oh, they do. There's one defendant, just 24 years old, who got a 10-year sentence. He spent his cut on a high-end honeymoon in the Maldives. Yep. He shelled out $30,000 for jewelry in Dubai and bought a $64,000 Dodge Ram pickup. I mean, this wasn't survival crime. This was theft to fund instant, very visible luxury.
That detail really anchors it. But what makes this a true deep dive topic is how the fraud just metastasized. It didn't stay in that one program.
Not at all. The sources show it spread really fast. It started exploiting other state services, most notably the Housing Stabilization Services, or HSS.
And even autism services programs.
Exactly. The HSS fraud, in particular, it just reveals this deep systemic vulnerability. This was a state program for housing services. And once they figured out how to game the system,
it became a cash cow.
A massive, rapid cash cow. We're talking defendants pocketing $300,000, $400,000 each and using that money for luxury cars and for real estate as far away as Kenya.
And here's the crucial context for you, the listener. You have to look at the program's budget. The HSS payout, it ballooned from just $21 million in 2021.
To an astonishing $104 million by 2024.
A five-fold increase. In 3 years.
That's the signal. I mean, That right there is the primary financial red flag of unchecked, widespread abuse. It got so bad, the state just terminated the program entirely last October.
It suggests just a profound lack of oversight.
Absolutely. And it was similar in the autism services sector. The allegations there focus on one company that billed the state $14 million.
And the mechanism was different there?
A little. Here, they allegedly paid kickbacks to parents in the Somali community to enroll their children for treatment. And critically, this included some kids who didn't even have a previous diagnosis.
Okay, so that's the criminal side of it. Now we have to talk about the political and rhetorical fallout, which was intense.
Immediate and intense. Governor Tim Walz responded. He paused payments for 14 state Medicaid programs. He ordered a third-party audit. He's promising accountability.
But he's taking a lot of political heat for it.
Oh, heavy fire. The state Republican opposition, you've got figures like House Speaker Lisa DeMuth. She's saying this fraud is probably the tip of the iceberg.
And blaming him directly.
Right. Stating the whole failure falls squarely on his shoulders. The sources make it clear they're using this as a major political liability.
And the rhetoric just... it didn't stay local. It leaped onto the national stage, and it got a lot more generalized.
Yeah.
And inflammatory.
Very quickly. We see reports of former President Trump on social media and in meetings calling Minnesota, and this is a quote, a hub of fraudulent money laundering activity.
And he didn't stop there.
Yeah.
The comments targeted the Somali immigrant community directly.
Yes. The sources report him referring to them with the word garbage and pledging to end temporary protected status for Somalis immediately.
And this is where the facts of the crime really start to separate from the, you know, the political weaponization of it.
Exactly. And that, of course, triggered some very strong counterarguments. Ahmed Samatar, he's a Somali-American professor, he condemned the fraud itself, called it a serious civic betrayal.
But he pushed back hard on the rhetoric.
Very hard. He criticized the unhinged rhetoric, and he highlighted that the vast majority of the 80,000 people of Somali descent in the state are, you know, law-abiding professionals, doctors, nurses.
Senator Amy Klobuchar also defended the community, right?
Yes, she did, yeah. Pointing out their essential role, saying they, quote, work in our schools, work in our airports, help take care of our seniors.
We also have to address the most... politically charged allegation in the source material.
The security angle.
Right. A report from a conservative think tank. It claimed that millions of these stolen dollars were funneled to Somalia and ended up with Al-Shabaab.
The Somali branch of Al-Qaeda. And the sources do confirm that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has taken this very seriously. He said his agency would investigate it.
Okay, that brings us to our second high-stakes segment. This one deals with military ethics, political infighting, and a really dramatic revision of American foreign policy.
And it all centers around one person, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
What's so fascinating here is how you have multiple high-pressure controversies all converging at once.
Exactly. You've got the ethics of a military operation, and then that's followed immediately by this highly sensitive issue of classified information security.
So let's start with the Caribbean strike back in September. The initial facts seem clear. A military strike on a vessel they suspected was ferrying drugs.
Right. But the controversy, it all stems from the second strike, conducted by Navy SEALs on the burning wreckage.
While there were survivors.
At least two survivors were seen clinging to the hull. And this is what prompted former military legal experts, JGA officers, to argue this could be a war crime.
Their argument being you can't target survivors who aren't an imminent threat.
Exactly. Not an immediate imminent threat to your personnel. Representative Jim Himes also said publicly he found the video footage disturbing.
So what was the political defense after that criticism?
It was immediate and it was robust from Republican allies. Senator Tom Cotton, for instance, he called the strikes righteous. He claimed the survivors were trying to flip the boat over to stay in the fight.
But there's a key detail that contradicts that.
A very key detail. Admiral Frank Bradley later clarified that he was given, and I'm quoting, no such order, to give no quarter. This suggests a real disconnect between the political framing and what was actually happening operationally.
And that disconnect seems to extend internally, too. What do the sources say about the private reaction among Republicans?
That's where you see the friction. Even powerful Republicans like House colleague Mike Rogers were reportedly upset with Pentagon officials.
For what reason?
For failing to provide Congress with detailed legal justifications for the strikes. So they were defending it publicly, but behind the scenes, they were frustrated by the lack of internal legal cover.
Okay, so if the Caribbean strike was about operational ethics, the next controversy, Signalgate, is squarely about procedure, classified information.
That's right. The Pentagon Inspector General, the IG, issued a report, and it found that Secretary Hegseth risked the potential compromise of sensitive DOD information.
Yeah.
By using a signal chat chain, you know, a supposedly secure messaging app, to share classified info about upcoming strikes on Houthi targets in Yemen.
And the fatal error was?
The chat chain accidentally included a reporter who had been added by the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz.
So the IG report, it didn't pull any punches on the risk here.
No, it concluded that if this information had gotten out, Houthi forces might have been able to counter U.S. forces or reposition personnel and assets.
So a direct threat to U.S. forces. Given that finding from an independent watchdog, how did Hegseth respond?
He issued a categorical denial, claimed, quote, total exoneration, case closed.
Total exoneration? I mean, how do you square that with the IG's findings? It seems less like a legal defense and more like...
pure political spin. That's what it looks like. And the sources show a really clear split on this. Established Republicans like Senator Wicker, they quickly backtracked from earlier statements where they had admitted mistakes were made.
To what?
Now they're claiming Hegseth acted within his authority.
But not everyone bought that.
Not at all. That narrative was completely rejected by retiring Republicans. Senator Tom Tillis and Representative Don Bacon, they just flatly refused to accept the exonerated claim. One called it total baloney.
And that shows you the divide, right?
Yeah.
Between those who are politically invested in the administration and those who feel free to, you know, offer an honest assessment on their way out.
It's a very clear line.
All of this is happening as the administration quietly releases its new 33-page national security strategy, the NSS. What's the fundamental shift here?
This is the dramatic part. The NSS fundamentally shifts the core focus of U.S. national security. It moves away from traditional global commitments, NATO, Europe, the Pacific, and puts it squarely on the Western Hemisphere.
It actually says that.
Unequivocally, it states that border security is the primary element of national security.
Wow. That is a huge defining statement. The sources call this the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah.
Can you just quickly contextualize that for us?
Absolutely. The original Monroe Doctrine, 1823, basically said the U.S. would oppose European powers interfering in the Western Hemisphere. Keep them out.
Okay.
This new Trump corollary applies that same idea, but not really to external military threats. It's focused on internal and hemispheric issues. It's about using the U.S. military, specifically the Coast Guard and Navy, to stop migration, drug trafficking, and outside influence from adversaries.
And they name China specifically.
Yes, naming China's efforts to gain economic and military footholds in the region.
So the primary job of the military under this NSS is border and hemispheric defense. But where does that leave our traditional allies? Because the language on Europe is pretty pointed.
It's extremely provocative. The strategy criticizes Europe, suggesting it's in a state of civilizational decline. And here's a shocking detail. It explicitly questions the long-term cohesion of NATO if some member states become majority non-European within a few decades.
I'm sorry, say that again. It connects NATO cohesion to the ethnic makeup of its members.
That's what the document says. This is a strategy that champions Western identity and promotes strong traditional families as a foreign policy goal.
It sounds like it's injecting identity politics directly into international security alliances. So what about traditional adversaries like Russia and China?
The language there is fascinating and contradictory. Towards China, the sources say it's careful and far from inflammatory. It says it wants a genuinely mutually advantageous economic relationship.
And Russia.
It pulls its punches on Russia almost entirely. It reserves its harshest, most critical language for our own allies in Europe. I mean, this just rips up the playbook we've been using since World War II.
That is a tectonic shift.
Okay.
If our first two segments dealt with colossal political and security volatility, let's pivot now to financial volatility.
A perfect pivot.
Specifically, that wild, sudden swing in investor confidence about the Federal Reserve's interest rate path.
This story is a perfect illustration of how markets react to information, or I guess more accurately, a lack of information.
We're looking at a big rebound now, and expectations for a rate cut by December 2025. But just a little while ago, it was a moment of real panic.
The drop was stunning. Expectations for that December cut just plummeted. They went from a fully priced 100% certainty all the way down to less than 30% by mid-November.
The market basically stopped believing the Fed was going to act. Why?
It was a convergence of three key factors. First, you had one Fed member vote to leave rates unchanged in October, which signaled some internal friction.
Okay.
Second, Chair Powell's messaging was mixed. It created genuine confusion. But the third factor was maybe the most crucial. The six-week government shutdown. It caused an almost complete lack of economic data.
The data fog.
Exactly. When the data fog rolls in, certainty collapses. Investors have nothing to anchor their expectations to.
And you could see the impact in the market immediately.
Oh, it was tangible. That collapse in confidence caused the tech-heavy NASDAQ 100 to fall nearly 9% from its peak. That's a huge move based almost entirely on perceived uncertainty.
But as of December 2nd, the rebound is complete.
It is. The market implied probability for a 25 basis point cut is back above 90%. The expectation is the federal funds rate will be between 3.5 and 3.75% by the following week. Certainty came back just as fast as it vanished.
So looking ahead to 2026, what are the key uncertainties that are still out there? What could surprise investors again?
Well, there are some major structural shifts coming, and you really need to keep your eye on three areas. First, Chair Powell's term ends in May.
So a new leader, new priorities.
Potentially. Second, the economic data has to finally clarify now that the shutdown distortions are gone. We need to see the real picture.
And the third point, this major policy shift. The Fed is ending its pandemic-era policy of shrinking its balance sheet. What does that mean for us?
It's complex, but it's vital. Shrinking the balance sheet is quantitative tightening, or QT. For years, the Fed was letting bonds mature without replacing them.
Taking liquidity out of the system.
Exactly. It removes liquidity and tends to push long-term rates higher. Ending that policy means a major, subtle lever that influences those rates is being retired. That fundamentally changes the monetary landscape, and it injects a new variable that can easily surprise investors.
We've covered a colossal amount of ground today. From the systemic failure that let a state program get raided for over $100 million, to the intense defense of questionable military actions and a foreign policy pivot that redefines who our allies are.
And these events, taken together, they really underscore the challenge of processing high-intensity information today. The details of the Minnesota corruption, you know, revealed through meticulous court filings, they struggle for our attention against these sweeping, almost philosophical shifts in geopolitical focus in the NSS.
And meanwhile, the markets demand this constant, exhausting vigilance based on every new data point.
Exactly.
So to leave you with one final thought, particularly connecting the Minnesota scandal and that new NSS emphasis on identity.
Right. The source material presents this presidential rhetoric, describing certain immigrant groups as garbage.
Well, the sources also note there's a pretty low political price paid for that kind of generalized racism.
So the question for you to mull over is this. Does the repeated use of inflammatory generalized rhetoric, rather than just focusing on the specific facts of a crime committed by a small group, does that become a uniquely powerful political tool?
A tool that ultimately determines how a national issue is perceived, regardless of the consequences for the actual group being targeted.